That was so nice, Gloria. You're my favorite. My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. And I would like to thank Dick and Barbara so very much for all the effort that you put into, and for also for what an example you both are to me and how you share honestly about your life. Thank you so much. Thank you. And I would also like to thank Leslie. Is Leslie here? No, that's me. I'm coming to you. And Leslie... yesterday drove me all the way up to Dahlonega because my friend had driven me here and I'd left my coat in the car, and she very nicely, and I got a new sponsee because I asked her to tell me her story on the way up and she hasn't stopped yet. Thank you. And of course, I'm so delighted to be with my sponsor, Clancy. I owe him so much. But I'll get into that, and I'll tell you about some of the trials and tribulations I've put him through. And I've loved all the speakers so far. They've been absolutely amazing. And I'm so sorry to be following Sheldon, but I'm very happy you had lunch first. And that's called pride. That's one of the defects. I'll tell you a little bit. When I first did step 6 and 7, I really did it. I wasn't monitored. I had had a slip. I'd had about 4 months sobriety in Edmonton, Alberta, and I had a slip. And I called my sponsor at the time drunk, and consequently, she fired me. And I decided that I was going to do the steps by myself. When I got sober after that slip, I developed shingles. And for the first 3 weeks of my sobriety, I was in bed, more or less, trying to get to meetings and in bed. And I sat down and I wrote out my 4th and 5th step because I could not bear myself. I could not bear consciousness because, you see, my defects of character started long before I ever drank. And I was not a nice human being long before I ever drank. In fact, drinking made me really nice. I never ever liked people. There was a lot wrong with me. There was a lot wrong with me mentally, and there was a lot wrong with me morally. I was brought up in a good Roman Catholic home. My father had been a Franciscan monk who left the monastery because of some doctrinal dispute. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. And I was born with a criminal mindset. And I don't know why. My stealing, my thievery, started with an apple. Just like Eve in the Garden of Eden. And when I was about 6, it was just after the war. I was born in Scotland, and all of our food was rationed. And I had never had an apple, because all of our, everything we grew, the farmers grew, that used to go for the troops. And I remember the American GIs had sent big crates of apples to the schools. And I got this beautiful big red apple, and I loved it. And I ate it all immediately, because even at age 6, I suffered from immediate gratification. And it was so nice that I decided I wanted more. And there was no more for me. But the other girls who did not suffer from delayed gratification had put their apples in their pockets in the cloakroom. So I decided I would go and help myself to their apples. And I stole 3 apples. And the nun took me and said, "Did you steal those apples?" And I said, "No, I didn't, but I'll help you to look for them." So that's how it was for me in the beginning. So, and then I went on to do many other bad things and broke my mother's heart and just stealing all the way. I got fired from my first job for stealing. I got thrown out of school at age 15 for hitting a nun, you know. And I've made amends to many nuns since then. But I was very undisciplined. Because I was so full of fear, my fear turned to aggression. And I became very aggressive at an early age. And then all the things that I had done as a drunk, and horrible, terrible things that there's no place for it from the podium, but they were really bad, and I'm not exaggerating. I hurt people and physically, and did a lot of things that I thank God for the fourth and fifth step for. So when Bill wrote published the big book in 1938, he only had two paragraphs on step 6 and 7. 15 years later, he wrote the 12 and 12, where there's two chapters. I wonder what happened. I guess life happened, like it happened to me. Because that first run around, when I got better from the shingles, I was about 5-6 weeks sober, I called a Jesuit priest who was also an alcoholic and heard fifth steps. And I went down to that Jesuit priest and I told him my story as best I could. And he was very, very helpful to me. And I got rid of all the horrible stuff that used to sit right here. I don't know if you know what it's like when you try to get sober and when you're conscious and then consciousness kicks in and all the things that you did and it's unbearable. And the only solution is a drink and oblivion. So I wanted to clear off all that stuff that was sitting right here. I did many other fourths and fifths after that, but that one was the most important one for me. And when I came out, I'd been in that seminary with him for about, I don't know, 4 hours, 5 hours. And when I came out, for years and years, because I had lived on the street, I used to walk on the shadows. I always walked in the shadows. I never raised my head up. I was so filled with shame and hate and anger. And I remember coming out that day and crossing over to the sunny side of the street, literally. That's what it felt like for me. And I was so filled with the spirit of whatever had gone on between me and that beautiful priest. And I went home and I took down the big book. And you know, in the big book it says, you know, did we try and make mortar without sand? You know, because we're building an arch in which we can walk a free person. And it says, we take our book down from the shelf. Well, I had my big book in my hand. And because the priest told me now I had to follow instructions, I went home and I put the book back on the shelf. And I tell my sponsees to do that today. I say, if you're going to follow instructions, put the book back on the shelf and then take it down and then read it. And that's what I did. And I looked at them, and it's like Sheldon said, nobody understands 6 and 7. I thought, these are no big deal. Let me go on to 8 and 9. However, I went on and did my 8th and 9th and did all my steps, and then life kicked in. And I remember my sponsor before Clancy was a woman called Rini. She died with 53 years sobriety. And I remember her saying to me one day, when she was really angry with me, she said, you're going to have to do a step 6 and 7 again. I said, why? She said, so that on your tombstone, it doesn't say she died of explanation. She said, because you keep doing all the wrong things, and then you try to explain to me why you've just done it. I said, like what? She said, well, she said, look at the day I told you to meet me for lunch at noon. And I was there at noon, and you didn't come. And I left. And you came at 10 past 12. And then you called me and were angry at me because I wasn't there. And then you're trying to tell me that you were there, but it just took you longer to get from your car. She said, lateness is a defect of character. Right? She said, you've got to care about me. You've got to honor my time. And it's utterly selfish. So I am going to ask you to do step 6 and 7 again. So then I took her and she said, I'm going to ask you to do the 12 and 12. And also what had happened in the interim between Rini telling me that was, Rini, when I was 2 years sober, the old timers used to say to me, Mari, we usually say no relationships for a year, but for you it's 2. Because you have a propensity for getting married. So when I was 2 years sober, I met this wonderful man on a Sunday morning in a meeting. I looked down the table and I saw him. And I just knew that God had sent me my reward. And John was 5 years sober and I was 2 years sober. And he had big blue spiritual eyes. Which I found out later were latent psychosis. But if he was attracted to me, then there was something wrong with him, because I was red hot sober. They used to call me Bill W's great granddaughter, and I used to run around with a book and tell people they were doing it wrong. And so John and I fell in love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 2 years sober, he's 5 years sober. I still go to a lot of meetings, and John would be there, and someone would ask me to read How It Works, and my eyes would flit across a crowded room, and I would see John. And I used to see Bill and Bob up in the sky, under the circle and the triangle, with Carl Jung slightly to the side, saying, bless you, my child. It was such a beautiful vision. And I shared it with my sponsor, Rini, who had no romance in her soul. None. And she said, don't get married. I mean, I told her how beautiful it was. And I thought it was God. God. This was God's gift to John and I. And I told her the vision I had. She said, honey, don't get married. You're an emotional retard. And I knew she was jealous. So John and I eloped. And it did not work out well. And not because we didn't love each other, but I still had so many defects of character. And also I still had a hatred for men. I didn't realize that. You know, when I used to get drunk, I used to kill men, try and kill men. I don't know why, not my fault. I remember one time I was in the mental institution, and you see, it's only in here you laugh at that, you know. I was on lithium. I was being treated as a manic depressive, and I was on lithium and librium, and all the lovely yum yums, librium, lithium, valium, yum yum. And the psychiatrist who was looking after me, he came to me and he said, Mari, we're sending you for assertiveness training. And I said to him, assertiveness training? I don't need assertiveness training. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband. He said, that's not assertive, that's aggressive. Alcoholics don't have enough self-esteem because you're so full of rage and anger that you're aggressive. You know, when you don't have rage and anger, you can be assertive. So I realized I was full of rage and anger too. So Rini told me, you hadn't followed much. She said, everything I've told you to do, you've done the opposite. You don't know how to take instructions. And you have to sit down and you've got to take out this book. And you've got to remember that the key to step six is willingness. Are you willing? And at that stage, I was willing. Because at that stage, even although I had a few years sobriety under my belt, I still had these defects of character kicking in. And I couldn't believe it because I thought like Bill thought. You know, where is it? And I think it's here. He said, having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, can't the same thing happen to our defects of character? You know, that's what I thought. I thought if I had said the seven-step prayer, God would look after it. But I didn't. And I was shocked with myself. And, you know, I've got to tell you this. I mean, I was just a few years sober before doing this, and I wanted to go and buy a cantaloupe. And, you know, I hadn't stolen anything in the first 3 years of my sobriety, but I wasn't quite cash register honest. And I wanted a cantaloupe. And I went into a store, and cantaloupes were selling. They were $2.50. And I said to myself, self, you're not paying $2.50 for a cantaloupe. So I got all my shopping, and at the end of the counter was a cantaloupe in a paper bag. I said to myself, it must be God. I took the cantaloupe home and I ate it. And I had two sleepless nights over a cantaloupe. So something was happening. And I called my sponsor, Renee, and I said, Renee, I've got to tell you this. I took a cantaloupe and didn't pay for it. She said, well, I want you to go back to the store, get the produce manager and make amends. I said, okay. So I went back to the store and I said to the produce manager, well, I always lie when I'm trying to be honest. And I said to him, I inadvertently took a cantaloupe. He said, that's okay. Where's the cantaloupe? I said, I ate it. But I want to pay for it. And he said to me, we can't take your money without the produce. But I want to tell you something. If everybody in the world was as honest as you, this world would be a better place. I walked out of that store and my feet did not touch the ground. And I said to myself, in future, I am going to be rigorously honest. And I have tried to be, to the best of my ability. So certainly, that was a big part. That stealing had been a massive part of my life since I was very young. The other thing that had been a massive part of my life, I mean, I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. It's not exactly the city of brotherly love. There's a lot of religious antagonism. You know about that, Dan. You've been there. And it's kind of a like Belfast, in a way. And I developed anger because my grandfather, who was a brilliant man, brilliant, I mean just brilliant, he was so brilliant, he was a miner. Because that's the only job he could get, because he was Irish Catholic. And yet he had this massive IQ, he had this massive learning. He taught me to read when I was 3-4. And I was so upset that the job he had applied for, he didn't get, because on the paper at the time in Scotland, you had to put down your religious denomination. And I had a lot of anger about that. I had a lot of anger about the stuff that went on that was anti-Catholic. And that was part of my aggression. I haven't spoken about that before, but there you go. That's so good. And then when my grandfather died when I was 10 years old, I could not believe that God, I got angry with God. You know, because I loved him. He's the only one that truly understood me. My mother never understood. My mother wanted a daughter like Shirley Temple. She grew up in the Shirley Temple era, and she got me. But she got my she got Shirley Temple when my brother was born, 6 years later. He's been tap dancing his way through life ever since. And, you know, so my mother, you know, she was, and I don't blame her. I mean, all the stuff that she put up with. I ran away from home at 15 and went in and lived at the Salvation Army. She came to get me. I threw her down the stairs. I used to steal her money. And my mother loved me. And I treated my mother abominably. And she was dead before I got sober. And my father was dead before. And I thank God for the steps because I couldn't have lived with it. I could not have lived with what I did to those loving parents of mine. And so my grandfather, he dies. And I don't know if you know about this, but in the old country, when people die, we keep them in their open coffins in the bedroom. And we have wakes, you know. And everybody comes and they sing and have to celebrate the life. And I remember trying to wake up my grandfather. You know, because they were singing his song. And I developed this hatred and anger against God. And an obsession with death. Absolutely obsessed. Another big fear of mine. Obsession with death. So I had all these angers inside of me. And then I went on and went into life and got married. And began to get angry with the man I was married to. And then had these beautiful children that eventually, because of my alcoholism, were taken away from me. And I had a terrible anger against the father. Up until recently. And I thought it was gone. It was not his fault. When my son was 11 years old and I had taken them out of the country and living in Canada, he'd lived 2 years with me as a hopeless alcoholic. And when I decided to go back to Jamaica, he wrote to his father and said, I don't want to be with mommy anymore because she's going to kill my brother and I driving drunk. And yet I blamed my children's father for taking my children. Thank God he took them. You know, thank God. So I had this anger. And then the anger with that, my first husband that I married, the AA man, I remember with Clancy. We were about 2 years married, I think, and he's going on and on and on and on at me and criticizing me and all day long. And I'm there cutting up a piece of roast beef. Do not be cutting roast beef if you're having an argument and you're newly sober. And I attacked him with a knife. No, I did not pierce skin. But I got such a rage and I couldn't believe it. And I called Clancy. I said, I just attacked my husband with a knife. He said, well, I told you not to be around knives. And and then, you know, when I had done this, I mean, when I was doing this step six again and entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character, you know, I was looking at it and I was thinking, my God, you know how I see these steps today? Once upon a time, I thought they were just little steps thrown in there between 5 and 8. You know, on the steps that are going up to a better spiritual awakening, a better spiritual plateau in my psyche. This is how I look at them today. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then there's a plateau. Just there's concrete steps, and then there's a little piece of concrete like this before you have the other 5 steps. And this little piece of concrete here is steps 6 and 7. And if this one falls, the rest of them collapse. That's how I see it today. I see them as the most important steps today because they are the steps that give me the most problem, even today. And you see, what happened to me too was that the desire for control came back in. I forgot about my powerlessness. I forgot that I was turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And I began to take control of my children's lives again. And I wanted my children to be happy. And I didn't want my two sons to argue. And I used to sit them down and I used to say to them, I want you to be happy. I don't want you to argue anymore. And then one would call me and say, well, guess what, he didn't. And I'd lie about it. I'd say, no, he didn't. You can only imagine, I was taking control of their lives again. This desire to control the universe instead of just saying, okay, God, I'll pray for them and I'll put them in your hands. I want to take control of life. And people are my defect instigators. There's a wonderful line in Moby Dick. It says, when the chill November winds are blowing about my face, and I feel myself growing grim about the mouth, and I want to go out into the street and knock people's hats off, I know it's time to go to sea. When I feel myself going grim about the mouth, I know it's some defects that need attending to one more time. And what I do sometimes is I know I've done something, or I'm just not feeling right about something, and I know it's a defect that's coming up. It's a defect to control the universe. And I'll go out into the malls and I'll tell people they're not putting the clothes back on the hangers properly. Or they've got too many groceries in a 10 grocery line because I've counted them, you know. I start taking it out on other people. So this step one more time was for me, it was looking at the mea culpa. Who am I really? This is the building of my character that I'm going with here. And there's a lot wrong with me about which a lot has to be fixed, and it's going to take a lifetime. I believe 6 and 7 are lifetime steps. And what I came to face was that when I have the willingness to do this, we're entirely ready, then I have to be completely honest in my spiritual practices and in talking to the people that are in my life, my sponsor, about what is going on. It is so easy for me to get into a place where I can deviate morally one more time, where I can get into a rage and anger, and I think it's gone. But I'll give you an example. And this is just 4 years ago. I truly believed that for many, many years, I had that rage, that horrendous rage I used to have. It was like, my children used to call it napalm. It would be, and then it's done. So I was working for a woman that God had put in my life to test my serenity level. And I was there for 4 years. And she used to throw files at me. And I used to say, act well. Clancy used to tell me, you can think what you like, but you got to act right. And I used to think, I'd really like to take one of these files and pull it around her scrawny little neck and just go, but instead I just say, you shouldn't upset yourself so much. Everything will get done. Anyway, I put up with 4 years of that. And then one day I walked in, and it was just her and I in the office. And as I walked in the door, she threw a file at me. And it must have been a day I was not in fit spiritual condition. And I went and I closed the door and I said, God, I'll see you when I come out. And I took her inventory from when she was born. And I had that rage. Now, it only lasted, I don't know, maybe 3 minutes. I don't know. But I looked and she's sitting cowering in the chair. And she said to me, "I don't think you're feeling well. You should go home." I said, "Do you go home. I've got work to do." She left. She ran out the door. And I knelt down and wept. I wept from shame. I was so ashamed. And I asked God to forgive me for treating one of his kids like that. And also for me staying in a situation that I should not have been in. When my sponsor was telling me to leave it, I stayed in it. So I called my sponsor at the time, and it was Norma, and I told her what happened. And she said, I told you. You're always staying in relationships past the expiry date. She said, I want you to go in the morning and make amends and then give a week's notice. And I did that. I was able to do that. And the way that this willingness comes about me all the time for step six is because I actually know today, if I don't treat someone the way I want to be treated, I have a conscience. I don't like myself. I get willingness through not feeling good about myself. I don't want to feel that way anymore. You know, I lived a life where I just could not bear myself. And I just don't want to be there anymore. And I never ever thought I could change. And these to me are the two transformational steps. These are really where I'm coming face to face with everything on a daily basis. You know, because I have an amazing ability to make benign, well-adjusted people behave like morons. I mean, it's just a natural ability I have. And I remember when that husband of mine that I married in AA, him and I eventually became friends, and we separated, and we stayed in the same building. And we got along as friends, because I loved him, he loved me, we just couldn't live together. And I remember when we were fixing out the separation agreement, and I began to get some anger about that. And him and I had a big argument in the lawyer's office, and I lost it because I didn't think he was being fair to me, but I realized later I was being unreasonable. And here's what happened to me. We went back home, and we were supposed to go in another couple of days and finalize everything. And I tried to get him on the phone, and I can't get him on the phone. And I know he's here because his car's in the garage. And at that time, my son had come up and was staying with me. And I said, "Let's go upstairs and see what's going on with John." And I had a key for the door. And I put the key in the door. And the door was bolted on the inside. And my son and a neighbor knocked down the door. And John's lying on the ground. He had a massive stroke. And he was turning purple. And the window was open. And the hospital told me if he'd been there another 8 hours, he would have died alone. They said he'd been lying there for 2 nights and 3 days. And now when I saw him, and I thought the last time I left him in anger. Over money. Over money. And I remember waiting for the ambulance to come and lying down beside him and holding his head. And he couldn't speak. He'd had a massive stroke. Massive. Half his brain had imploded. They told me that that it was like he woke up in China and everybody's speaking Chinese. He had severe global aphasia, which means he couldn't understand the spoken word and he could not speak. You ask him to touch his nose, he doesn't know what that is. And he was in hospital for 18 months. And I went every day I could. Every day. And I don't know if he understood me when I said, I'm sorry. So I had to show him by my actions. Because I believed he was still in there, even though he couldn't communicate. And I remember the shame I felt. Imagine, I'm all these years sober. Look at that. Look what's in front of me. And then they asked me if I would take him home. After some years, he had another 8 months in the behavioral center because he did not behave well. There's only two words my husband could say, and you can't say them from the podium. But what they mean is take a journey, you know. And I was so grateful that they'd given me that opportunity. Because you see, even although I am in the spiritual program of action, even although I am in here, as my sponsor Clancy says, no matter how spiritual I get, I never rise above human being. You know, I know God is all forgiving, but can I forgive? Can I forgive myself? No. So I figured that this is God's way of saying to me, okay, take him home and look after him. And you know, I was never there for my parents. I was not there for my children. I get a chance to take John home and look after him. And he was childlike. Clancy saw him a few times. He had right arm paralysis. He had been a brilliant lawyer. He couldn't speak. He couldn't read. But you know, he used to hum to me. He used to hum night and day and pat my face. And that to me was his forgiveness. So even although I had messed up in the program of AA, I got a chance to make amends in the program of AA. I got to do a living amends. And it was the most spiritual form of loving I've ever known. And he died in 2001. And before he died, I read him How It Works. And I held his body till he grew cold. And I finished something of meaning and worth for another human being. Out of that rage and anger, out of that broken relationship, out of those broken dreams, I was able to do something worthwhile. And that's how I usually get to be doing things that are good and worthwhile. Because I screw up. I mess up from time to time. And I don't mean to do it. You know, there's a wonderful old, I think it's Aesop's Fables, that I used to so identify with. It's about the scorpion and the frog. Do you know it? You know, the scorpion wanted to get across the river. And he asked the frog, can you take me across the river? And the frog said, how do I know you won't sting me? The scorpion said, why would I do that? If I sting you, we'll both drown. I want to get across the river. And the frog said, okay, do you promise? And he said, I promise. He said, jump on. And they're halfway across the river. And the scorpion stings the frog. And they're both drowning. And the frog said, why did you do that? Now we're both going to die. And the scorpion said, I couldn't help it. It's in my nature. And I used to think these things were so deeply carved in my nature that I was so self-obsessed that nothing could cut through it. That this bondage of self that I had said the seven-step prayer about, that it had still got me claustrophobically within myself. So that when I have a desire, not anymore, thank God. You know, not anymore, but once upon a time when I had a desire, even in sobriety, it didn't have to be for, you know, desire is not always about sexual desire. There's desire for many other things, you know. Like, you know, but, I mean, we have to, you know, there's no spiritual Viagra, you know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, You know, you've got to have a desire, a deep desire to get this thing. But I've had desires for stupid things that have come over sometimes my moral standing and my moral values. Or else when I feel that, I remember Clancy used to tell me about this illness of perception that I have. And that sometimes I will get a distorted perception about relationships. And I remember one such time, and this is years ago, he helped me with it. I remember I'm into a meeting and there's this fellow standing there. And I said, "Hi, how are you doing?" And he ignored me. He looked right through me. Now, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. And I think he's rejecting me. So I said it again. And he ignored me. It was like he was looking right through me. So I went home that night. And I thought about him till about 3 a.m. And I thought, tomorrow I'm going to go to the meeting he goes to and I'm going to confront him. So instead I called my sponsor. And my sponsor said, instead of doing that, the next time you see him, why don't you just say to him, "You know, I saw you the other night at a meeting and you seemed to not answer me, or did I do something?" He said, "I'm so sorry, Mary. My mother died in Montreal and I was just thinking about it." It had nothing to do with me. Nothing. But you see, I've always it. The tests that have been done on alcoholics at various stages of sobriety, it says it will always be a little emotionally immature and sensitive. When the great I am is being threatened, when my sense of self, my ego, what is ego? Easing God out. And that's what I do. One more time, it's all about me. Whole life's all about me. Gluttony. I don't know if anybody in here suffers from gluttony. I did it up to last night. I had a huge piece of chocolate cake, which I shouldn't have, because it says in the book, you know, gluttony, you know, you're going to damage your health because of gluttony. So I have this huge piece of chocolate cake. And there's two other pieces of cake I haven't tried yet. And I think I'm going to... And then... This is how I think about it, so you know. It's a wee bit weird, but... I had my DNA done recently, and it's like 98% Irish and Scottish, and 2% English. So I'm sitting there last night, and I'm saying, you know, I really like those other two pieces of cake. And my English side... The Queen. said, "Do not do that. Practice self-restraint." My Irish-Scottish side, which was the part of me wanted to drink all the time and the other part didn't want to pay for it. My Celtic side says, "Go for it, kid." And I ate it. And I went back to my room and I thought, that was gluttony. That was gluttony. You never eat that much cake. It must have been because you were sitting next to your sponsor, Clancy. And he took the two that you wanted, so you were left with a chocolate cake. And always trying to rationalize, always trying to rationalize. The natural desires that I was born with were always way out of whack. I am so grateful today to be 75 and to never not have that stuff I used to have. You know, it talks in here about lust and love, you know. And how often in my young life did I confuse the two, you know. Like, and I remember when I started drinking, because I, you know, I was an introvert before I drank. But when I drank, I mean, it just loosed me up. It was like I'd go up to somebody and, "Hi, let's get married. What's your name? I love you." you know, no restraints, you know. And so often I was confused. Now, certainly, I have been diagnosed. I know there was something mentally wrong with me. I'll tell you how I know. When I was about, well, it doesn't really matter because it's just, I was told by some priests that there was certainly something wrong with me. It was a personality disorder. It was a strange personality disorder. It was a borderline personality disorder. And I have no doubt that's true. I have no doubt. Everything in my young life tells me that that was absolutely true. Because, you know, I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. I did not know a drink would fix it. Alcohol was my medicine. Alcohol was the thing that gave me a sense of ease and comfort. All I wanted was a little bit of shush in the world. That's all I ever wanted. And that's what alcohol gave me, until it didn't. Until I was right back to being the reprobate I always was, but a drunken reprobate. A feral alcoholic. And the seven-step prayer, which now I say every night, take away my defects of character. Relieve me of the bondage of self. God, show me the way. Help me so that I can help others. Because in order for me to be able to be a channel, I've got to get rid of this stuff that blocks me off. Because having relationships with people was always difficult for me. It took me 15 years in AA before I began to feel comfortable in the room. And I got it from Clancy. When I had been back in Jamaica in sobriety, my sponsor had told me to go back and make amends to the island. And on my way back from there, I stopped by Clancy's yard. And I remember I was standing away from everybody. And I had on a cloak with a hood and sunglasses, completely apart. Because I wanted him to come and pay attention to me. And he's too smart for that. But I didn't know how to mix with all these people. These Los Angeles people that are so easy to get along. Everybody loves each other. I didn't know how to do that. And he walked past me and he said, mix. I said, what? He said, mix. He said, let me tell you something, honey. If you're feeling different in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're dead. You're in trouble. And I realized that was one of my defects right there. Wanting to feel different. Wanting to be special. As Clancy said, in order for me to feel okay, you got to treat me special. And that's me setting apart again one more time and not being what God created me to be. So there was so much more I wanted to talk about, but, you know, my time is up. And I cannot stress to you today how good my life is. And how much I always want to be a healing in my family's life. And yet how every now and then I'll take back control and want it all to be the way I want it to be. Because I've written a script about my old age. And I want my old age where I'll just be a lovely old woman smiling benevolently at people. Bless you, my child. And some days, but not often, you know, I let that spiritual image down one more time. So I want to thank you so much for having me here. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much.